Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. I just wanted to start out with a quote, and this is from Ben Franklin's autobiography. And if you're reading along, this is from page 61, 62 in the Dover edition or page 76 in the Norton critical edition. This library, and this is Ben Franklin talking, this library afforded me the means of improvement by constant study, for which I set apart an hour or two each day, and thus repaired in some degree the loss of learned education my father once intended for me. Reading was the only amusement I allowed myself. Now, to me, that's an astounding quote, and we'll talk a little bit about his age here in just a few seconds. But the last two programs, we had what I call the instructors panel, and Mr. James Brandon and Mr. Brandon Nice came in, and we did talk about how Ben Franklin at 12 was so driven to become a writer, and what he did to educate himself about writing was just amazing. Well, today what we want to show you is that really never stopped. His drive to improve himself just continued the rest of his life, and that's something that we really need to consider about this book and realize this is what's most important about this autobiography. It's not so much the history of his life, but about what he did in his life to improve himself. And we've already talked about how many things he accomplished in his life, and we'll come back and we'll talk about some more of that later. But here's this quote goes on. And I want people to think about this in terms of what is happening in our world today. He goes on, he says, "I spent not time in taverns, games, or frolics of any kind, and my industry in my business continued as indefatigable as it was necessary. I was in debt for my printing house. I had a young family coming on to be educated, and I had to contend with, for business, two printers who were established in the place before me. My circumstances grew ever daily easier, my original habits of frugality continuing, and my father having among his instructions to me when a boy frequently repeated a proverb of Solomon," and here's another quote, "Seest thou a man diligent in his calling? He shall stand before kings. He shall not stand before mean men." Now that's taken from Proverbs 22 and verse 29. I don't know which version he was referring to there. It could have been in the Geneva Bible. That was very popular, along with the King James Version, or the Authorized King James Version. But here's that same proverb in the King James. It says, "See thou a man diligent in his business, he shall stand before kings, he shall not stand before mean men." Now, this is an amazing quote, and here's why I think it's so amazing. Ben Franklin, when he talks about the library, what he's talking about the year 1730, and at that time, Ben was only 24 years old. But he was already into improving the lives of others with starting that library. There were no good bookstores south of Boston. Of course, we know he set up his print shop in Philadelphia. And even when he came back from England, and now all of you will have to catch up in the book, and I'm sure you've already read part one, but he brought a portion of those books back from England for this purpose, to help others improve their lives. And so it is really, you know, quite astounding what he did. Now, remember that proverb, and here's what he also says just a few lines down from where he just ended the quote. This is a new quote. He says, "I from thence considered industry as a means of obtaining wealth and distinction, which encouraged me, though I did not think I should ever literally stand before kings, which, however, has since happened. For I have stood before five, and even had the honor of sitting down with one, the King of Denmark, to dinner." Now, some of the people have talked to me about some of the difficulties of reading the book, and it is a little hard to get the chronology. But remember, even though he is writing about the 1730s, remember he's now in the year 1784 when he's writing this part of the book. So it's well after the Revolutionary War. It's well after Benjamin Franklin established himself as one of the leading founding fathers. He was even working with France to help establish the nation. And we know that he also stopped writing the book for about 4 more years after this section. And then he started writing it again in 1788. But here he's writing on his deathbed, and he couldn't even lift a pencil to do it himself, so he had a stenographer come in, and we'll find out the exact details of that later. I should have written it down. But I think it was actually his son, William, that was helping him finish the autobiography. So he virtually was continuing to write it to the day he died, or maybe the second he died. So this is astounding. Here, Ben at 12 was just doing all these incredible things, you know, really driving himself day and night. Any extra time he had to study, he was studying about writing. But that never ended. And so today what I thought we'd do is I have invited back the 60-plus panel, and I do think the next 12 or so pages of the book, and that really takes us to the end of part two, are probably the most helpful in the book. Remember, this book is the premier self-help book for all time, and people still see it that way. So if you look at our world, we are cursed with the distractions that just easily waste our time. And of course, one of the things that maybe you have to get a little bit older, like us 60-plussers, but there's a great truth about time. You cannot save it up for another day. Once time is spent, it's gone. And so with me today, I have, again, Robert Harmon.
Hello.
He does our reading for the blind and our seeing impaired readers, and he does a lot of work here. And I also have invited back my sweet wife, Deborah. So I just thought I'd just open it up, kind of shut my mouth a little bit, and just to hear what you both have to say on this section. Again, we're talking about in the Norton, we're talking about up to the page 88, and I think in the Dover, we're talking up to about page 68. So how did this section of this part two impact both of you? And I'll just let whoever gets there first to take the mic.
Okay, well, I guess I can start. It's all right. Well, what affected me was I thought it was great that he had such a desire for self-improvement. And he talked about, it was about this time, I conceived the bold and arduous project of arriving at moral perfection. So here he wants to really arrive at moral perfection. Not only, I mean, he had this drive to be a better writer, and he was always really energetic and had a really good work ethic, but he also wanted to incorporate good morality. And so the virtues, I thought, that he listed virtues and then set about a way of trying to develop those virtues. And then, of course, he used the time management as part of that. So,
yeah, it's kind of interesting. He originally started out only with 12 virtues, correct?
Yes.
And so there is, I know some people really fault Ben Franklin for this part of the book. They, of course, in today's world, I mean, I don't want to be too sarcastic, but who really cares about virtues? And why would you want to set out a program to become morally perfect? But there is some, I think there's really some interesting tongue-in-cheek things here. But here's some of the things on his list. Now, he did put them in order. And one of the first things on his list was to be temperate. And what he meant by that was not to eat not to dullness, nor drink to elevation. And we all know about, we talked about his desire for vegetarianism, and he could actually save money to buy books. And that's why he really liked vegetarianism. The next point he thought was a moral virtue was to be silent. And he said, speak not but what may benefit others or yourself. Now, for anybody that's really read the Bible, you know some of these are the same values from there, or some of the same virtues. The third one was order. Let all things have their places. My desk could use that today. But let each part of your business have its time. Another one, he said, resolution. Resolve to perform what you ought. Perform without fail what you resolve. Talks about frugality. I think everyone knows what that is, or maybe they don't. But he says to waste nothing. And he also said, don't make any expenses that are but good for others or yourself. And then he also talks about number six is industry. Lose no time. Be always employed in something useful. Cut off all unnecessary actions. So he goes down through those. He talks about sincerity and justice and moderation and cleanliness. He also talks about chastity. But then he comes to number 13. And maybe my wife, who was raised Quaker, could talk about that story just a little bit.
Well, he only had 12 at first, but I guess a Quaker friend of his mentioned to him that he really had a lot of pride, and so he decided he should add humility as number 13. So he said at the end of the... Do you want me to read that?
Go ahead.
Okay, yes. At the very end,
This is a free discussion, by the way, dear.
I thought it was funny the way he says at the end that... in reality, there is perhaps no one of our natural passions so hard to subdue as pride. Disguise it, struggle with it, beat it down, stifle it, mortify it as much as one pleases. It is still alive and will every now and then peep out and show itself. You will see it perhaps often in this history, for even if I could conceive that I had completely overcome it, I should probably be proud of my humility.
That's tongue-in-cheek. Now, a lot of people fault Ben Franklin. I mean, he was a very intelligent person. He was really genius. His genius for writing was in between the ages of 12 and 15. I mean, at 15, he's writing these silence do-good essays on the importance of freedom of speech. Now, this is a 15-year-old teen. And so, but he did, I think, he knew he was vain. I think he knew he had certain talents and genius. And I do think he really tried hard to not offend other people. But we know, for example, that John Adams was very jealous of Ben Franklin and Ben Franklin's talents and abilities. And, of course, unfortunately, they came back and attacked, I think, Ben Franklin and his virtues, and you can read that in McCullough's book. They accuse him of all these mistresses in France, and I think, you know, some more recent history has shown that that just wasn't true. I mean, he did believe, we talked about this the last couple programs, where he did believe women should be educated, and he did believe women did have minds, and they were valuable, and they could carry on great conversations, and so that doesn't necessarily make him a womanizer like some have tried to paint him up to be. So let's get into this whole idea now of time management. I do think that that's interesting. I mean, we can come back and talk about some of these other virtues later. And I think everyone does need to remember that Ben really does use a lot of humor. Sometimes it's hard for us to pick it up because it's 18th century writing. But maybe, Robert, we can get into this, the time management. I think, let's see, I have the Norton Critical Edition here. I'll ask you, Deborah, to tell me. Let's see.
Page 68.
Yeah, page 68. It is fascinating that, he did set himself this schedule to overcome his weaknesses. And I do think if you read that section, we're not necessarily going to spend a lot of time with that, but it really sounds to me a lot like what Paul was going through in the book of Romans, where the good things he wanted to do, he couldn't do, but the bad things he wanted to do, he was still doing. And I think Ben Franklin really came up across that same problem, and he talks about that in the book, and that's when he would just go after one virtue a week, and he would tick every day when he fell into that virtue. Or fell away from that virtue. And if there was a week where he didn't have that problem. Like, for example, the temperance, you know, if he didn't get drunk or overdrink or didn't overeat, then he didn't have to tick anything. And he thought, well, if I could do that for a week, I must have overcome it. And I do think he's being tongue-in-cheek there. I don't think, you know, he's really, really believed he had completely overcome it. So, but let's get into this, the two virtues, the one of order and industry, according to, you know, the schedule that he set for himself. And I know that, you know, Robert has to have a busy schedule, and I know he has to, you know, schedule his time. So, Robert, what do you think about this schedule that he came up with? And again, remember now, he's 24 years old.
Well, I think it's very thorough. It's been well thought out. You know, to start out your day, rise, wash, and address powerful goodness. You know, whatever he believed in and whoever he believed in. Obviously, he was praying to that that power. And that's how he started his day. And I think that's a good way for all of us to start our day. And then he would think about his business after he had prayed, you know, and so that kept everything in order and putting first things first. And then to present study and breakfast. So then he would go to his sustenance and start eating in preparation to go to work. And I think that's a good order to put things into to start the day. And it starts it off on the right foot. Then you work for the 4 hours, and then you take your noon break, and you do some business, checking over the accounts to see how they're doing in the midst of while you're eating, in preparation to go work the second half of the day. And I think that's just everything in order. And I think it's good for not only young people to create this habit, but it's something that I think older people have created throughout their lifetime in order to live a good life and in order to be productive all of our life, not just for 20, 30, or 40 years and then retire to do nothing. And like you were talking about Ben Franklin writing this until his up into his point of even dying. He was still at work in a sort of way where he was writing his autobiography. And I think it's due to the schedule that he kept and yes. keeping everything in order and also keeping everything prioritized.
Yeah, I think that what's really amazing to me is that if you notice on this schedule, and I believe Ben was really honest, but if for those of you that might be listening in for the first time and haven't read the book, I know there are some of you will be doing that, but he actually began every day at 5 a.m. And, you know, he did do that. He said he got out of bed, he washed, and he did, he said he addressed the powerful goodness. Now, a lot of people feel that Ben Franklin was not a religious person, and I do not believe that's true. I do believe that Ben was against hypocritical religion. And, you know, we dealt with this in a couple other programs. You know, when he was in Boston, the Cotton Mather and his father Increase and his son Samuel, they were kind of like the Boston elite, and they were in control of not only the politics, they were in control of the societal norms, and they really wanted to control people. Then Ben, of course, he didn't like that, so he became a Presbyterian, and he didn't like that either because he said Presbyterians worked at being good Presbyterians, but they did not become good citizens in the sense that they were all, I think there's one point he says where this one minister was his friend and he made him come to church for 5 weeks, and he said he was so bored with all the polemics. You know, and everybody was just talking about all these things, you know, about not sinning this and not doing that and doing that. But then after church, everybody went and did what they wanted to anyway. And so I think he was against that kind of religion. But I definitely believe he believed in an all-powerful God that did help him. And I do think it's interesting that he began his day with that, like you said, Robert. He began his day, you know, worshiping that God, or you know, worshiping what he believed and establishing that first. And of course, you know, here we have we're taping here from Herbert W. Armstrong College. You know, this radio program, the radio station, you know, the college, it is sponsored by the Philadelphia Church of God. And of course, our namesake, Herbert W. Armstrong, he worked hard until his last dying breath as well. He died at 93, and he was still very much speaking and doing some things in that 93rd year, except for the last few months. I remember he got sick in September, and I think he was dead then by January. So it is something that's really important. And I think one of the other things that's really important with his schedule is, very first thing in the morning, he also asks himself, what good shall I do this day?
Yes, that's great. He's thinking about, he seems like he does have an emphasis on how he can help other people. So I think it is great to think about that, to think not only about his work, but what he's going to do that is good, you know, in terms of what he thinks is good.
Yeah, the other thing he did then at the end of the day, he asked himself the same question. In other words, on the last two programs, we talked about these panels, the instructor panels. We talked about how even at 12, Ben had this incredible drive for self-examination. Well, he seems like he's still doing that here at 24. And of course, we know he did it even, you know, later in his life. And of course, Mr. Stephen Fleury, just recently on A Trumpet Daily, is talking to those of us that say are 60 plus, and he wants to know, well, what are you accomplishing in your life? You know, we still, even though, you know, some people retire, you know, maybe at 62, or maybe some people retire at 65. I mean, there are still very productive and high quality things that we can still be doing at our age. I know the one thing that's just amazing to me is here I am, I'll be 64 in, I think it's next week. And or maybe it's even this weekend, I can't remember. Sorry about that. That's what happens when you're 60 plus. But anyway, you know, someone was asking me, that, well, when are you going to retire? And I said, I'm not going to retire. I just have this opportunity to begin a radio program and be a radio host. I mean, I am really enjoying this. I'm probably enjoying it more than some of the readers are out there. But why do I have to stop? I mean, I feel like I have youth and vitality. I don't want to stop. So my wife is smiling at me. She doesn't want me to stop either. She doesn't want me to come home all day, you know, that kind of thing. So, Robert, weigh in on that. I know you're a busy man, so.
Yes, I try to keep as busy as possible, keep my mind occupied. And it takes scheduling. You have to do everything by a schedule as close as possible. Now, Benjamin Franklin did point out the fact that sometimes that schedule was disrupted because of the fact that you are dealing with other people, especially when you're in business for yourself. Sometimes you have to have meetings later or earlier than you anticipate. And sometimes you have to deal with friends stopping by and entertaining and things like this. And so I think he took all these into the equation, but still he tried his best to maintain that schedule for various reasons that benefited him and his family and his business.
Yes. Yeah. One thing I think it's interesting there is that he said he didn't go to taverns or he didn't go and to gamings, or he didn't frolic. But I think it's interesting on that, it's page 85 of my book, but from the hours of 6 to 9, part of the things he would do there, he said he would, first of all, he'd organize his day again, put things back in their places, then he'd have his supper, then he would either perform music, I mean, or he would use diversion, or he would get into conversations with people. So it wasn't like he was just working all day long. And it wasn't just that he was like just had his nose in the book all day long. He knew that you needed some variety and balance. And so usually he spent about 3 hours with those kind of things. And I do know, of course, I do work with a lot of very talented people here at the college, and of course we do work together quite a bit on producing our publications. And I do think sometimes that when we schedule things, we may make it so tight that we don't allow for, well, interruptions, or we don't allow things that things might go a little bit bad, or how do you recover? And so we could be frustrated, but still we must maintain schedules. And I know a lot of people will say to me, "Hey, Mr. Leap, I don't have time. You know, I like listening to your program, but I don't have time to be reading books." And yet you will find out that they maybe are really into sports and they do watch a lot of their sports programs, or maybe, you know, they're into maybe some videos and things like that. And I do think where Ben set a difference is he did those things that actually improved his thinking, or he did those things that improved his education, or he did those things that improved his mind. And so I do think that's really very, very important that we do get on a schedule. I believe you can do whatever you want if you schedule it. And if you really don't want to do something, you're not going to even put it in your schedule. I know there's a lot of other people say they don't have time to exercise, when really they do have time if they just put it in their schedule. So I'm just realizing we're running out of time. Let me just say one other thing here. It's just always so shocking how fast time goes. But once it's gone, it's gone. You have to remember that. So he does make this this other quote. And I do think for husbands and wives out there is you really need to work on this together. If you're going to set a schedule, make sure you do it together. Here's another thing he said. He says, "We have an English proverb that says, 'He that would thrive must ask his wife.'" He said, "It was lucky for me that I had one as much disposed to industry and frugality as myself. She assisted me cheerfully in my business, folding and stitching pamphlets, tending shop, purchasing old linen rags for the paper makers. We kept no idle servants. Our table was plain and simple, our furniture of the cheapest. For instance, my breakfast was a long time bread and milk and no tea, and I ate it out of a 2-penny earthen porringer with a pewter spoon." So that is a really great quote. So you need to do this together. And so I think what we'll do, 60-plus panel, I don't think we have necessarily mined everything out of this that we could. So I'm going to invite you back again. But for all of you out there listening, remember that you can follow me on Twitter, and that address is at JBLiterature1. You can also write to me at the email address is JBL@PCOG.org. I really look forward to your comments. And what I'd like to say is just remember we are going to be reading the play Hamlet. And so that's going to be a challenge. Ben Franklin's a challenge. We're going to step up that challenge. Get out, get your schedules going. And until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.